Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Well, hi once again. It is time for another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. Thanks for dropping by. Thanks for being here. We have a fascinating guest today. I think he's kind of fascinating, and you're going to probably be quite engrossed in listening to what he has to say. I'd like you to meet Carlos Ochia Cady. Carlos is a father and a husband. He is a hospital administrator. He has also become extremely interested in space and space travel, and we'll talk a lot about that. He also has had some exposure to being a person with a disability. We're going to talk about that and kind of how he's worked through all that. He's got some good spiritual insights, and I think that what he has to say will resonate and kind of help us all. So, Carlos, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. How are you?
And doing well, Michael. It's truly being an honor that you invited me to share this time with you and your listeners and viewers and readers today.
Well, thanks for being here and giving us a chance to get to know you better. So, as I usually kind of start these episodes, tell us a little bit about you growing up and kind of where you came from and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
How's that for a technical question? That sort of stuff.
Yeah, of course. You have to define yourself first. So you were right. You know, I really enjoy defining myself as what I do in life, my values. I'm a father of two amazing children, great husband, very loving family, and always want to kind of start defining yourself within that context. In terms of where I come from, I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. My family was one of those that in the 1980s moved to the Orlando, Central Florida area. And right now there's 500,000 Puerto Ricans in the area. That was kind of the first wave that moved into the mainland. So over the past 30 something years, Orlando has been my home, but because of other commitments in terms of education and also military commitments, I've been literally around the world. I still consider Orlando my home and my place of birth, Puerto Rico.
So you spent time, I think, in the Navy, right?
I spent 12 years in the Navy. I was commissioned as a medical officer in 1988. And what they did, essentially, they paid for a scholarship that they paid for my medical school. And at the end of medical school, I had to pay back with my time. And when I finished my medical school, they gave me a deferment to do my residency. I was a pediatric resident in Orlando. And during my second year, they decided that the numbers had dropped and they needed me to come on board. So my destination was an aircraft carrier that was already deployed in the Mediterranean. This is about 1993. So I spent 3 years in the Persian Gulf and in the Bosnian War supporting the missions during those years.
What is it like being on an aircraft carrier? I've heard it described as really just literally a small city, but what's it like?
It is a small city. People don't realize that that how many people we actually have on board. So the carrier by itself is about 4,500 people. This is the people that are assigned to the carrier, and these are different capacities. My capacity was medical officer. There's about 300 to 400 officers. The rest are enlisted personnel. But when the carrier gets deployed and it goes at sea, we get an additional 3,000 people. One time we have 4,000 people. So there was a period of time that we have the air wing. So you think about the people with the planes and the maintenance and the pilots and all the support team, but also 1,000 Marines that were attached to the carrier at that time. So for a period of about a few months, we have 8,500 people. And I enjoy, that's the part that I enjoyed the most about my military career, was being deployed in the carrier. We had, you know, definitely place to eat. We have a post office on board. We have a church. We have different type of services in our chapel. We have everything that you can imagine. We have our own TV station. So we are a very self-independent unit.
So did they show a lot of like US programming? And of course, like most TV stations, did they show a lot of reruns?
I tried to remember the TV, but I remember that was not something that we all did. Actually, the TV station that we had, that we have our own programming, was very popular because, of course, you know, you like to see the people that you see every day in a different capacity. But there were movies that were shown. There were, of course, the news. And I think one of the things that I like the most and sometimes I miss is being deployed during a period of time that it was a war going on and we were part of it and we were supporting those operations, that you felt that you were part of history. So when you saw the news and they were talking about something, this was not something that was happening somewhere out there. It was actually you in the middle of it. And that kind of excitement was just something that sometimes I miss. And also, I think the way that we work as a team, the work that we support each other, the camaraderie with the other shipmates. I think, you know, out of the many things that have shaped my leadership style, I would say that my military career has been one of the most influential factors in shaping who I am today as a leader.
When you had those 4,000 extra people on board, the people who were not normally part of the ship complement, did that create real challenges, or did everyone get along because you're all trained to work as a team, or what?
We all work to work as a team. People don't realize that an aircraft carrier is an industrial complex. You have in the bottom of the ship, you have two nuclear reactors to power the ship. And in the top of the ship, you have an airport with 85 planes taking on and off 20 to 24 hours a day. So we all have a specific function, not only in our own departments and our own roles, but we also have a function to protect the ship. So we get into a situation that there is something that is threatening us. We actually have to go in something that's called general quarters, which is a significant major threat to the ship. I mean, everybody have to go and battle and then staff their battle dressing stations. That means when there's a threat to the ship, everybody had an area assigned in order to support what you will think operations that might lead into an attack. And we did that one time we were crossing the Strait of Hormuz, entering the Persian Gulf, and there were some Iranian ships that were very too close to the ship. And then we went into general quarters because we didn't know there was a hostile action being taken against. And the other time that we went was actually a submarine that was getting very close from the bottom of the ship and then got within a certain perimeter. And we didn't know that that's the purpose of that submarine was to gather information in terms of intelligence or was a hostile action. So we went into general quarters that time.
What was your position in general quarters?
So I staff and led the forward part of the ship. So you think about it, the ship is in different compartments. And if you have an attack in one section of the ship, you kind of seal off that section from the rest of the ship. So the fire or the damage doesn't spread to the rest of the ship. So that area had to be fully manned from, of course, every single logistics, engineering, services. But in my case, I was there to support medical support. So anybody that is wounded and to administer care.
So when your tour of duty was over, what did you do?
So when my duty was as a full, full-time, let's call active duty, decided to just go ahead and finish my training. And I was in Norfolk, Virginia, and I was trying to decide what specialty, should I just go back and finish pediatrics or do some of the other areas. My intent at that time was to do emergency medicine for pediatrics. And my second choice was to do pediatric anesthesia. The options in pediatric anesthesia were better at that time than in emergency medicine. And I was lucky to be accepted at the Johns Hopkins University. That's where I did my training in anesthesiology and pediatric anesthesiology. And my department was combined with critical care. So we were, was a very comprehensive program that covered all those three areas.
So you went to Hopkins and you kind of worked through that and were an anesthesiologist or what exactly did you do?
Yeah, so I finished as a pediatric anesthesiologist. And after my time in Hopkins, I decided to stay there. They definitely have very good professional options if I stay within the institution. But my family was in Florida. There was a significant family pool. At that time, my daughter was born. She was 6 months old. And I wanted her to be closer to, the grandparents and the family. So we decided just to go ahead and move to Florida. And I started working in Palm Beach County. So in South Florida for many years.
And you're still there?
Well, from South Florida, I went to Central Florida, which is actually my home, but I was the closest to Florida to Orlando at that time, being in Palm Beach County. And so I moved back to Orlando about 2002 timeframe. And I've been pretty much here since then, with some periods of time that I've gone somewhere else. I went back to South Florida for 18 months to develop a program there and then came back. So it has been a little bit of in and out period. And during my time in South Florida, that's when I discovered that I have the type of glaucoma that I did. So the diagnosis was made in year 2000 while I was in South Florida.
So that led to you obviously becoming some interest in the whole issue of vision, vision impairments and so on. So what happened to you? How much were you involved with dealing with that glaucoma?
Oh, significantly. I think my journey, this is now 22 years of experiencing glaucoma and all the complications from that, truly has shaped my life forever. And it's hard to kind of summarize 22 years of the medical treatment, the many chapters that I went through. But I can try to go briefly. At the beginning, I would tell the story that I was ironically working with an ophthalmologist in ophthalmologic surgery for children and eye doctor. And at the end of the day, everything was well. I was on my way home, and driving home, I started seeing that my vision went white, like a very dense fog. And as it was starting becoming worse, I pulled the car over, I waited, it really became a really white out. And over about 20 minutes, the vision recovered. Then I was able to go home. And at that point, I just decided to call the same ophthalmologist that I was working with that day and say, this happened. I knew that something was wrong, I just didn't know what. And he said, no, you need to come and be seen immediately. So I get up my car, go to his office, and he started examining me during the measurements. And then you get the famous hum. And you say, well, this is not a good sign. I know something is wrong, I just don't know why. And I was very anxious for him to tell me. So at that time, my pressures were in the high 50s. What is normal for intraocular pressure is somewhere between 10 and 20. And he monitored very aggressively. We did 4 drops and 1 medication called Diamox. And my vision and my condition was stable until like about year 2004, when I started losing vision on my right eye. And when that happened, I was told, you know, you need to go to the best center for eyes, which happened to be in Miami, which is not too far away. I was in Orlando at that time. And went there, and they decided to do surgery intervention. They placed a valve in both of my eyes, and this valve controls my pressure. So it's a passive mechanism. Once the pressure goes above 12, the valve opens up and drains fluid from the eye to the posterior part of your eye, and the pressure is normalized. And a year later, the same problem that I was having with the right eye started happening with my left eye, which is my dominant eye. We all have a dominant eye. And the pressures went into the 70s. And when people try to say, oh, how can I compare 70 pressure to something that I know better? Imagine your blood pressure that is normally 120 over 80 being 500 over 300. That's the best analogy that I can give. So they were excessively high. But my eye actually, it was pretty good, pretty good shape. You know, I didn't have any problems. And when I, they decided to implant another valve in my left eye, and I lost vision. I went into disability for about a couple of months. And I was doing well until about 2013, when I started having cornea damage, likely secondary to the placement of the valve and the tubes that go into my eyes. And I had my first cornea transplant in 2013 in both eyes. And I was in disability about 2 months and another 3 months. So it was a prolonged period of time. So when I tell my story, I tell people it was not just one episode of dealing with visual impairment. It was multiple episodes at different times.
You had a lot going on, and you eventually had to have corneal transplants and so on. How mentally were you dealing with all of that?
During my first set of transplants, I did well. You know, I'm one of those very optimistic, I'm like a realistic optimistic. And the optimism is something that kind of drives me forward. So I felt pretty confident that this was going to be it, that these transplants were going to give me long-term control of my vision, and I was going to reintegrate what I was doing, which I did in 2013. But that didn't last too long. In 2018, which is 5 years later, I started gradually losing my vision more, the whiteout, the kind of what's called cornea edema, that led into my second set of transplants. And that's, I was out in disability for about 3 months at that time. And again, you know, this optimism that I have was very good until 6 months later that set of transplant failed one more time. And then I said, okay, this is different. This is a repeated failure. Something is not quite right. And when I talked to my medical team, I mean, there was no guarantees that they were giving me that if we were to do another third set of transplants, that was going to be the solution long-term. But that was the answer that we had at that time with the technology that we knew at that time. And I think that was probably my lowest point I got right before my third set of transplant that I received a few months after that. I went to zero. We're talking about totally blind. All I can see was motion in front of me. And I started kind of questioning my faith. I started questioning the why me. I started questioning what is it going to happen? This is going to be permanent. I decided to do a pilgrimage to Paris. I have been there before. Went to a basilica on top of the highest peak in the city of Paris that is called Sacré-Cœur, which I felt something spiritually special about that place. I went there, you think about a pilgrimage. And they said, you know, it would be good that you see one of our priests, but we don't actually have priests here. They have it in another church. It's called La Madeleine, which is Mary Magdalene, where the remains of Mary Magdalene are in the altar of that church. For the, ironically, the person that was running the church was a priest from Boston. And so he reconnected right away, and he administered me the anointment of the sick, which is the first time that I've been anointed. It's one of the sacraments in the Catholic faith. And when that happened, I started questioning, so what is going to happen next? Are we talking about a miracle? And I started questioning myself, am I ready for a miracle? It sounds wonderful that I can be cured, that this will go away. And I just didn't know what a miracle will mean for me. So I remember asking him at the end, and he said something that I carry for the rest of my life. He said, miracle is very different in different people. What you define miracle might be different to another person defining miracle. And keep in mind that your miracle might be that you will have the strength to go through what you're about to go through. And so I came back. I had my third set of transplants. And right before that, I decided, you know, I want to step down on my leadership position, which was hard. I felt like I was letting people down in my department and the hospital that I have worked for so many years. And I took an indefinite leave of absence because I didn't know how long this will take. Eventually, that leave of absence and disability lasted for 10 months.
And then?
And then I will say that that was probably the most difficult time of my life. But at the same time, amazing things happened to me that had transformed my life forever. When I had this third set of transplant, at the end of the surgery, we decided to do my dominant eye first, which is my left eye. My vision in the right eye was very compromised by the fact of the cornea edema that was happening, and I needed a transplant, but they didn't want to do the two transplants on the same day. They usually space them out just in case there's a complication or an infection. So that transplant occurred about 3 months after that. And my surgeon said, we are lucky. We got very young donors with a very high number of cells. So we got really, really good cornea tissue. And I said, great. She said, but this time you're going to be in bed 3 days, a strict bed rest compared to the usual 24 hours. They put a bubble behind your new transplant so it attaches into your cornea a little bit easier. So I couldn't do anything. My husband has to feed me, bathe me. I had not developed at that time the coping mechanisms when acutely I go from somebody that is fully able to now fully unable, at least from my perspective. And I think the one thing that carried me through those 10 months were some things that happened in the beginning. Definitely my family was extremely supportive, but also my faith really was very supportive during that period of time. And if I may share the story, it was day number two. I was going to see the doctor day number three in the morning. And I had my eyes, bandaged, and I couldn't see. And all I was thinking is, when they remove these bandages, I don't know how much I'm going to be able to see. Is the transplant successful? Do we need to do something else? If this is going to work or not? I mean, I have so many questions. And day number two, I was laying in bed in the hotel that was close by the hospital. And I started feeling, I was listening to music. Music was very healing to me. And I still use music as a way to heal and meditate. And as I was listening to music, the music started fading away. And I felt my body was getting very light. And I felt this wonderful feeling that people call grace. And I started levitating. And this episode lasted for about 3 minutes. At the beginning, I'm going to be honest, I was very scared. And then I realized what was happening and I became very peaceful. Once the episode ended, I knew in my heart that I was very confident the next day I was going to get good news. So when I woke up that morning and went to the doctor, even before the doctor examined me and removed the bandages, I had the very strong feeling and confidence that this was a successful operation. And at that time, I was just saying, okay, if you're going to do this, when does this happen in a very special place? You know, like just holding the hands of the people that you love, looking at sunset or sunrise and special place in the world. And I said, you know, why does it have to happen in a hotel in a Spring Hill by Marriott, which is not a bad hotel. I mean, it had free breakfast. And why did you pick up a better hotel? You start going through those kind of silly thoughts. And I think the message is that we have to be open to that. And that can happen at any time, in any moment. There's no special place. We have that capability within us.
I gather that when the bandages came off, you did have a successful operation.
Yes, when they took the bandages and they looked at my vision, it was somewhere between 2100, 2150, which is for a newly opened eye and, you know, definitely graft being implanted. It was pretty good. I never had that good of a vision after a transplant. This is my third time with a transplant. And after that, I will say that I was just very energized. I said, okay, maybe I don't need an indefinite leave. Maybe I can come back earlier. Of course, you know, you're a physician, so you know that you had this kind of honeymoon period. And then after that, some healing process was going to happen. So in the days to follow, my conditions started to deteriorate, meaning that my visual acuity, what I had that day, worsened, which is pretty normal as the inflammation process started taking place. And over those 10 months, I think you can go through all five stages of grieving. I will say that I kind of skipped the denial phase because I knew exactly what was happening. So I guess the beginning was more this kind of mixture of anger and bargaining. And the anger was more kind of, why me? One of the things that I love the most and I've been involved is with the movie industry and the independent side and working with documentaries and bringing social justice documentary from all around the world to US audiences. And I just said, the thing that I love the most, I might not be able to do it anymore if I completely lose my vision. And so started having that process of anger that followed with the bargaining. And the bargaining is, it sounds a little bit silly, and I don't know, some of your listeners may relate to this, but when I saw with my limited vision, someone that was either hearing impaired, someone with mobility issues that was in a wheelchair, someone that had other type of disability, you start saying, oh, wouldn't it be better to have that type of disability than the one that I have? And I felt bad, horrible for thinking that way, but that was, I guess, part of the grieving process. And that they started, my vision started getting a little bit better, but it took a long period of time. And definitely I went into a process of significant depression over a period of time. I need to seek mental health. And I think that was very instrumental in my recovery. And I did what we consider the standard mental health counselor and professional, but also alternative ways to for mental health. And I had a coach, a life coach, and I started telling her this, my story, and I started kind of sharing a little bit of some of the visions that I was having during this period of time about what will be next, what will be the next chapter in my life. And I started having this vision and these dreams about that I was going to at some point tell people about my story, empower people, and inspire people, that I was going to be either a motivational speaker or something in the similar, but I was going to share the story, and that story was going to be inspirational to others. And she said to me, pretty much, that's the same feeling and premonition that I had before meeting, I met you today and during our session. And another thing that I was trying to say, and I felt that I was in a safe environment with her, is since I had that episode of grace, that I had maybe another couple of those, I started feeling that my tactile senses and hearing senses were very heightened. And I know that's normal when you have one sense that is compromised, the other one tend to overcome that by getting stronger. But went to the point that I could feel the energy of a tree, of the ocean, of the people around me. And it was something new to me that I didn't have the capability. Maybe it was something she always said to me, I think you were born with that gift, but that gift never surfaced until now.
Yeah.
And so I think that was very instrumental to kind of maybe able to get that help. And I think that's when I decided to go through what we call the acceptance phase. And I think that is what really carried me forward to today.
How did you get involved with having a life coach? What made you do that?
Well, I heard many people about that, and the ironic part that she happened to be my front door neighbor. And so, of course, the access, the easy access really helped, because I just, we just have to visit each other. And we were all neighbors, and we already had developed that level of trust as neighbors and friends, not in that kind of capacity. And I knew about the work that she has done for others. So I felt very comfortable opening up to her, because we already had that friendship, neighbor relationship. So I said it was quite easy, but it could be very difficult for many people to seek mental health in general, and even more alternative sources of mental health. And part of that acceptance, and I think that kind of helped me to go to the acceptance phase. And one of the things that I wanted to do is kind of reach out to the families of my donors, something that I've never done before. I had multiple transplants from other donors. And so I contacted the Lions Bank, which is the largest eye tissue bank in the country, and say, is it possible that I can contact the donors? I know I heard that you can do that, but I just never thought that I was able to do that. They said, absolutely. The way it works is very low expectation, and we'll contact them, and they will be the ones to decide if they want to receive communication from you and if they want to establish some contact. We're talking about this is months after their passing, which is a sensitive period. I find out that my donor from my left cornea was a 28-year-old young man that died in an accidental way. And my donor of my right eye was a 46-year-old woman, also healthy, that died in an accidental fashion. So the Lions Bank contacted them and said, would you like to hear from one of the recipients? And they said, yes. So I said, okay, let me just write a letter. Imagine the emotions I was going through. What am I going to say? I mean, I wanted to say so many things about how their gift of light transformed my life. So I decided to say, to kind of discuss the issue of legacy. So I wrote him a letter, and I said to them, I would like to thank you for your decision to donate. In the case of the one of my donors, he was a young guy of 28 years old. I said, I would like to thank you for your decision to donate his organs. And this is a beautiful example of love and courage. And I would like you to know that his legacy lives and continues to impact the lives of many people. And it's my duty to honor his legacy with my life's mission to care for those who are ill and advocate for those who had no voice. And I said to them, it has been said that legacy is sowing the seeds on a garden that you will never see. Please know that this garden is now in full bloom and lives strong in the lives of many like me that have been touched by the gift of life of your loved one. They received the letter. They wrote back that they were very moved by my letter, but they were not ready to make contact with me. And I said, I felt so energized that I was able to kind of convey the message to them. And it was something that, an experience that I would carry for the rest of my life.
Well, and have you heard any more from them or?
No, I recently tried to establish an additional contact, but we're talking about 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do it again. Actually, the Lions Bank, I will be the featured recipient story for the annual report that is coming out in May. That may trigger them to receive a copy and maybe we can
establish a reach contact.
You know, it's a possibility, yes.
Time will tell, but it is tough. And everyone advances and deals with these kinds of challenging situations in different ways. So you've been the recipient and you've been able to reach out. And of course it was a pretty traumatic and challenging time for you. So I would assume that even you writing those letters had to be somewhat therapeutic and helpful to you.
Oh, absolutely. I especially when I did it, you know, you want to try. I mean, I wanted to write like a 10-page letter just saying everything that how this gift of life transformed my life and probably the lives of many others that probably receive other organs. I didn't know that part. These other organs were also donated. But, you know, you have to be brief and you want to kind of deliver your message. And for me, I was very comforted by the fact that they know that what their decision that they made that was very courageous in a very difficult time had transformed at least my life, and I'm pretty sure the life of many others. Everyone that becomes an organ donor, on average, you save 8 people's lives. So I know there were probably more than one person that were transformed by the gift of life. And this kind of acceptance kind of gave me the strength to say, you know, I'm going to overcome this and I'm going to go back to work and I have to give it time. But I have to kind of, I need to create a plan B. So my plan B was to say, well, since I've been an administrator, I can do that full time. I don't need to have the vision acuity that you need to have to do clinical. So I enrolled in a global executive MBA program, did a business degree, which I just finished in March 18th. And believe it or not, right now, the plan B could become plan A, but at least I feel comfortable that I have all options available today.
And so do you work as an anesthesiologist today?
Yeah. So after 10 months, I returned. Ironically, I returned to work March of 2020, the same week that the pandemic broke out. And I was able to, it was in some way helpful because I think a lot of the cancellations and the prioritizing the care for those that were having COVID-related complications helped me in two ways. You know, the caseload was lower, so helped me reintegrate to the kind of work that I did.
So you were saying?
I went back to work. I was cleared by my doctors to return to work in a part-time capacity in March of 2020. And which everybody knows that March 2020 is when the pandemic broke out. And it helped me in two ways, as there were so many cancellations to prioritize the care of patients with COVID and the related complications. It helped me a little bit of reintegrate to my work a little bit easier. And on top of that, the fact that my specialty was probably the best specialty, best suited to the needs that people had at that time, where the experts in respiratory management, ventilator management, airway management, skills that are very important in the early stages of the pandemic, So I felt that I was energized and even gave me a sense of a continual healing process, something that continues, even if you are clear to go back to work, you still continue your healing process. So gave me this energy to reintegrate to the kind of work that I was doing as an anesthesiologist in a quicker way, but also with a greater sense of purpose. You know, my skills are very well needed right now, and I'm making a very big difference to what the hospital and our community is going through.
So a couple of questions. One, I want to go back to life coaching. Do you still see her? Do you still do life coaching?
It's interesting that I did it for some time, and you know how life is, you know, things get busy. I went into business school. So I was doing 100% school and 100% work. So kind of the mental health, the continuation of that has taken a back seat. Now my clinical follow-ups, I mean, I go to Miami, which is about 3 hours drive or half an hour plane ride. I go there every quarter, every 3 months. So I had prioritized over the past 2 years. My last evaluation was about a week or two ago. It was pristine. They said my transplant looked phenomenal. And another thing happened, as if I may say, another spiritual story. The week before my appointment with my team, my transplant team in Miami, I was in Israel, and I have been in Israel for a couple of times before with the military. This time was more vacation. You know, my last day in Jerusalem, I knew about the blind man from Jericho, and we had been in Jericho the day before. And I said, where did this miracle happen that is being told in the Bible? And they say it happened in this pool that is in the kind of outskirts of the city of Jerusalem, the lowest point of the city, where historically all faith, the Jewish faith, the Muslim faith, and the Christian faith, all those people would gather in this pool to climb the mountain to go to the top of the hill where the city of Jerusalem is located. So it was a sacred place for all of them. And that's kind of the reason why the miracle happened there, because the people that had disabilities and blindness was a no-no, cannot go into the city. They were not considered worthy of going into the city of Jerusalem. And they said the problem is about doing this today is because it's a bad storm and it's raining. When I said raining, it doesn't rain there much. But when it rained, it's major flooding because they're not used to significant amount of rain. And it was raining, pouring, and I said, we can go there, but please know that they might not let you go in because that pool gets flooded very easily and they don't let people go there because they can have accidents. So I said, well, let's go. You know, I'm one of those that very determined person. So we go there. And as soon as we arrived, the rain stopped and they let me in. And I went to the pool, kind of recreated the story from the Bible about putting some mud in your eyes and then going to the pool and wiping your eyes off from the dirt. And when I did that, suddenly the sun came out and it was bright. And I looked up and it was bright. And I felt something special. And I said, okay, I was on my way to Tel Aviv. Let's go back to Tel Aviv. As soon as I left the area, the rain started pouring one more time. And I'm telling the story because it's similar to the story that I received right before when I got the third set of transplants to say, hey, your evaluation that you're going to have next week is going to be okay. So it was a kind of spiritual, but also very comforting. And I think all these things that I'm telling you right now kind of lead into what I am today, which is for the first time, I feel comfortable and empowered to tell my story. And my hope is for people to know that I think by now, people that have been listening, they can tell that this was not a one-time, this is multiple episodes of visual impairment, multiple setbacks, and keeping yourself with the hope and determination that you're going to overcome this, and to let people know that today I am very fully functional in 2025 and I have been able to overcome this. Going back to your question about mental health, and do I see a life coach, I think now that I'm telling this story, I'm going through this also a little bit of emotional time because I feel a little more vulnerable as I tell my story. But at the same time, it has been very healing and very empowering. So I think I need to kind of find that support again.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a life coach and a therapist? Do you have a thought about that?
The life coach is not a licensed mental health counselor. And that could be, you know, psychologist, it could be a physician, it could be a licensed clinical social worker. So there's many people that can be licensed. So they're not licensed, they're just more coaches. So they're not licensed in providing mental health counseling. But they also have provide other ways of therapeutic regimens that probably you might not get from traditional medicine. One of the things that I discuss with the life coach is I felt for many years, after this experience has happened, I felt the power of my hands having the ability to heal. And sometimes there's some things that I cannot explain that I put my hands over a person, over sometimes a plant, and something's changed after I did that. And she was starting telling me about a traditional alternative way of healing, which is called Reiki, something that is done in Japan, which is pretty much getting the energy of your body to go into your hands and placing in the area that needs healing. And that kind of energy encourages healing cells to kind of go from different parts of your body to go to that area and promote healing. And so that was one of the techniques that I used while I was healing and while I was doing disability to help myself heal, is to do some of that Reiki technique.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. How has your view of blindness changed having gone through all of the medical changes and so on that you've done?
I think, you know, leads to the second question is how my life evolved and changed since I decided to tell my story. And telling the story is for me to admitting that I'm a person that has been disabled, that have some minimal limitations right now, and I have the potential to be fully disabled in the future. So number one, I'm not afraid to be blind anymore. I know that this experience has empowered me, that the same way that I overcame the medical challenges and the multiple setbacks, I will overcome if blindness were to occur. And I started kind of thinking about what people with disabilities, blindness, mobility, hearing impairment, neural disabilities, the spectrum is so big right now. We have 1.3 billion people in the world with some type of disability. This is about 20% of the population in the world. And I started kind of uncovering the benefits in that people with disability brings to life, to an organization, to employment. And I started kind of nurturing and telling people that you have so much to offer and to also have the ability to advocate for them and talk to organizations to be open that with this diversity inclusion movement, in some way or fashion, people with disabilities were kind of not carried through this process the same way that the social justice movement in terms of race, gender, LGBT rights. The disability seemed to kind of took us not a step back, but they kind of back on the line. And I feel that we need to start talking about that. And this year was very empowering to have the best picture in the Oscar Award for the Sundance Film Festival for many years. And we always wanted one of our films to be selected as a best picture. And we have many that were nominated, but never won that one. And it was so good that the one that actually won for the first time in 35 years was a film about hearing impairment and about disabilities. And having a cast that was actually disabled, not pretending to be disabled. And that's, I think it's opened the up for me to see disabilities not as a problem, but actually as an asset, as something that we bring so much that to many aspects of life.
We often hear people talking about those of us who happen to be classified as people with disabilities as they call us disabled. And that means by definition of the word, we don't have the abilities that others accept as things that you need to have. And what we've learned is that there is a difference in saying a person is disabled as opposed to saying a person has a disability or something of that sort. Because the reality is that we all have challenges and we all have gifts. And I've said it before on this podcast, but what is really a disability as such? And we've got to get beyond thinking that because somebody is different than us because they don't do things like we do. Some of us don't walk. Some of us don't hear, as you said, some of us don't see. But we have understood that, and I'm glad you came to the conclusion that we have as much to offer as anyone else does. We may not do it exactly the same way, but that is where our value comes in. And the fact that we are able to show others in our ways the assets that we bring is hopefully something that over time will make the world more inclusive. I won't use diversity because diversity tends to not include disabilities anyway, even though every sighted person has the disability that they rely on light. So we could pick on that. But the fact is that we all have value, and it is high time that society recognizes that. And yes, I agree with you about the Oscar winners this year. That was great. And it was exciting to see that happen. I hope it will happen more and that we will see more actors with recognizable and maybe not so recognizable disabilities actually be included in all areas of the movie making, acting, television, and media industries.
And absolutely. And I think that's kind of with the movement of diversity, equity, inclusion, it is the inclusion part of the equation that is the most difficult. It requires an action. It requires a will by organizations and society to do that. But also kind of when I said inclusion is, you're right. I don't like the word disability, but it's the best word that we have right now because it means disability. You don't have the ability. So we need to see people not by what they're unable, but what they are able. And it doesn't matter the way that you're presenting. Yeah, are you in a wheelchair? Are you have mobility issues, visual issues, hearing impairment, neurodiversity, mental health, because there is some disabilities that are visible and disabilities that are invisible.
Well, and again, as I said, I could make the case that every single person on the earth has some sort of a disability. And that the reality is that a lot of the people don't have disabilities that they recognize as such because there's been enough technology and work to overcome those. But now we need to bring the rest of us into that and become more accepting than we are.
And in addition to acceptance, I also want people to kind of move from accessibility.
Right.
And I'm working with many organizations to kind of move that, the efforts that they're making, because I know they're making the efforts, and to move from accessibility to inclusion, especially in the business side. Now that I've, after completing my degree, I've been doing business school for the past 4 years, that there is such a thing as a disability economy. And there is a lot of innovation that is being, that people with disabilities are producing. I always say that we are in a constant innovative state. Every day we innovate because we're trying to accommodate our reality to a world that is not made for us. So we have to innovate. And sometimes you have good days, sometimes you have bad days. So whatever you innovated the day before, you have a bad day the next day, you have to re-innovate again. Imagine how transformational and powerful that could be for an organization. And so we need to start kind of bringing closer together the disability economy and the venture capitalists and investors to say, this is an area I can invest. I tell people there's 1.3 billion people market. These people have $8 trillion of income. And probably believes that is somewhere between $1 and $3 trillion of that $8 trillion is disposable income. So I signed to say this is a win-win. You create solutions, but if you actually fund and invest in people that are coming with disability products and solutions, those solutions not only can definitely have a potential to be business, have a business sense in terms of creating value, but also imagine that many of this, what people call special solutions, become universal solutions that everyone in society can benefit from. And the best way to do it is to be sure that people with disabilities are included in the leadership structure of your organization, so you can actually promote this innovative mindset that we all bring as something that we have to develop in our own lives.
Right. I want to switch to something else that I've been very curious about. And that is that you have become interested in space travel. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's my new, my new area. Carlos always gets into a new project from some time to time. And this is my new one. The way that I got interested, I mean, definitely as a child, you know, that's kind of your always childhood dream to one day be able to go to space and reach to the stars. And in my readings recently, this is a few months ago, I read about a story about a group of 12 disability ambassadors that were chosen by a company called or organization called Astro Access to do a special zero gravity flight. And of course, they chose different people of different types of disabilities. And when I read that story, I said, okay, I have always thought that space travel is completely off limit for people like me. You know, we will not qualify. We cannot be pilots. We cannot definitely qualify for the astronaut training. But when I saw that, they said, well, maybe we can do that. And now that we have the space tourism industry, that you don't have to be a fully trained astronaut, but you can still have the opportunity to go to space, I say, you know, why not me? So I decided to reach out to many of these disability ambassadors that were in that flight. That was in October of 2021. And I started learning from them how healing and empowering was that experience to them, that when they were in zero gravity, they didn't define themselves about what they were limited, but what they were able. They were floating in the air. They didn't feel that they have any mobility limitations. They didn't have any visual limitations, so hearing limitations. In that kind of environment, they were have a significant sense of freedom. And I said, well, I want to experience that. So I talked to the company and I wanted to say, you know, want to use this experience, not as a experience what they experience, but also maybe advance this disability inclusion message that disability inclusion can also happen in space travel. And I was kind of having some signs that I brought. So while I was in zero gravity, we were about 8.5 minutes in zero gravity. I was able to kind of show those signs to the cameras, and they had two photographers that were taking pictures, and people, you know, kind of create awareness about disability inclusions, about veterans, disabled veterans in space, and also promote organ and tissue donation. In addition to that, I knew that with glaucoma, there is some reports that there is some effects, visual effects of being exposed to microgravity. And one of the things that I'm more concerned about is elevation on the intraocular pressures and pressures inside mm-hmm. my eye. And those have been reported to be in healthy volunteers that they have increased somewhere between 10 and 40%. So I wanted to measure that myself. So negotiated with the company to do it in a safe way towards the end, the last minute and a half of microgravity. My pressures went up about 31%. So I was able to measure that. And that happened immediately after we entered zero gravity. And within 1 minute of leaving zero gravity, they went back to normal. And I'm believed to be the first person in history to measure with active glaucoma to measure the intraocular pressures in zero gravity.
So what's ahead for you in terms of space travel and your interest in this?
Yes, I mean, I really want to continue knowing more what happens with vision changes in when you're exposed to microgravity. I mean, right now, there has been some research that has been done, actually quite a bit of pretty good research. And we know already that your intracranial pressure increases in zero gravity, your intraocular pressures increases in zero gravity. And the spinal fluid that you have in your brain, the amount increases in zero gravity, primarily from recruitment from the spinal fluid that is in your spine that goes all the way up to your brain. And then so the ventricles, which the areas of the brain that hold your spinal fluid get enlarged, put some pressure into the eyes and the eyes get flattened. And these changes can last for, you know, days. They believe that the intraocular pressures tend to normalize by day number 3 or 4 of space travel. So if we're talking about the space industry and having anyone, including people with disability and visual disabilities with glaucoma, which is 100 million people in the world with glaucoma, to be able to have this experience, we need to make it safe for them. So the more we know about the effects, the more we can actually prepare them, maybe additional medications, maybe some acute treatment while you're in the zero gravity. So that way we can do this experience safely for everyone. And this has been well studied by many scientists. There is a term that NASA came up to describe this phenomenon. And one of the things that we see is that astronauts that are in space for a prolonged period of time, especially those that are there for weeks or months, when they return to Earth, their visual acuity goes from 20/20, 20/15 to like a 20/200. And that happens in about 70% of people that go, we have a prolonged exposure to microgravity. And there's other effects. In addition, you know, there's optic nerve and the edema, which is swelling of the optic nerve, the veins around your eye, they get more swollen, there's some retinal changes. So probably it's more multifactorial. It's not the increase in the intraocular pressures and the intracranial pressure that causes these visual changes. So we need to know more about that. So one of the things that I would like to do is continue having some opportunities to do this research, but not in healthy volunteers, in people like me, so we can make it safe for people like me to go to space.
So are the changes permanent?
Yeah, very good question. So right now, these changes last for weeks to months. There have been very rare reports that this can last for years, but they are definitely self-limited as soon as you return back to normal gravity. And the name of this syndrome is called space flight associated neurooptic syndrome. And as I said, it can be observed as many as 70 to 75% of people that is being exposed, have a prolonged exposure to microgravity. And so I did this for two reasons. I wanted to know how my body responded to microgravity. So when I do my space flight, I will be able to prepare myself and maybe talk to my teens, is anything that we can do, extra medication, right, that I can do right prior to enter microgravity and make this experience a little safe, not only for me, but for people like me.
Mm-hmm. So philosophically speaking, why should we be exploring space?
I think this is, I have to go back to the title of your podcast, The Unstoppable Mind. We as humans, humankind is in a constant state of evolution, in a constant state of exploration. You think about it, you know, we went in the past 6-8 billion years, we went from a one cell organism into multi-cell organism. In addition to that, you think about the explorers in the 14th and 15th century that decided to explore the world. We're talking about the famous Portuguese and Basque explorers that first started venturing into the world. This is part of our nature. This is part of human nature. This is part of humanity. And so the next step, the same way that when we established the United States, we wanted to do this kind of westward move to expand our country. Two things, because we wanted to explore what was west of what the 13 initial colonies had, territory that they had, but also because we wanted to discover what other things that we can actually discover there that can make society better. So we have been doing this exploration for years, and we are now naming this in some way, we say, to space for Earth. And why is that? Low Earth orbit colonization is the next step for humankind. That's the reason many industries right now, many companies, we're talking about dozens and maybe hundreds of companies, are developing what this new space station will look like. And most of them will be privately funded. And we're talking about hundreds of people in space orbiting the Earth in low orbit. I always say that this is going to be the next internet, because when you do that, then you have to create a new industry, a new type of economy. It's a service economy for those hundreds of people that are orbiting the Earth. There is also a medical research economy. There is also innovation economy, things that we can actually innovate there that can bring solutions and new products to make life better on Earth. In addition to that, the research and medical advances and producing new products, the products that we already have to innovate to actually service those space stations, mostly private, that we're going to be seeing in the years to come, the solutions that we have to create can actually be commercialized to create solutions for problems that we have on Earth. The same way that I was telling you, disability innovation can actually not only create special solutions, but create universal solutions. The same thing with space exploration can actually create not special solutions for the space industry, but actually create universal solutions for all of us.
How soon do you think we're going to see space colonization, low Earth orbit colonization, be a regular part of our society?
I think I would not be surprised that within a decade, we're going to be seeing more and more of this. These prototypes are already made. Some are being built. I think the next decade will probably bring more space stations, especially knowing that the International Space Station will be decommissioned in that period of time, in 10 years from now. I think they're trying to stretch it. Every so often they stretch it a little bit longer because it's a lot of investment that has gone into it. And the next step will be, believe it or not, colonization of the moon and looking at the resources that we can find in the moon. But also we can actually not only do colonization for research and medical advances and new product development, but we can actually move certain industry that can be polluting industries that can be actually placed in low orbit, so we don't have to worry about the side effects or polluting effects of these industries. We can actually develop new sources of energy. Imagine solar energy that we can capture even in a higher power and then that energy being beamed down to Earth, empower Earth in a clean, renewable way. So yes, I think the low Earth orbit colonization is something that we might see in a decade. Moon colonization is something that probably is a little bit down the road, but we're destined to be an interplanetary species. It's just our nature. I think, you know, it's within us, it's in our DNA to be unstoppable explorers, because collectively and individually, we all have an unstoppable minds.
Being a science fiction fan, I can't but think of Arthur C. Clarke and his proposal or visioning of a space elevator, an elevator that actually would take people into space to space stations and so on from Earth, that there would be a structure that would be 100 or 200 miles tall that would actually go into space. And that would have a synchronous orbit space station that would be attached to the elevator, and people could actually ride it up to the space station and go from there. Might be an interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about the Hyperloop that we're talking about, that connecting cities within minutes, you know, coast to coast within minutes versus hours of flight. The same concept can be applied to have a Hyperloop that connects the surface of the Earth with some of this low Earth orbit space stations. One of the things that also is being developed is to have, like, the same way that you have airline hubs, you know, like the Dallas and the JFKs, to have some kind of hubs in that orbiting space at the whole all times, and you can have a Hyperloop connecting Earth to this hub, and then from there people hop to their different space stations, to the moon, and potentially to other planets. You know, I always say that they always had taught us for years that the sky is the limit. And now we say, no, the sky is no longer the limit. The universe is the limit. Space is the limit. And I think that we're limited as a human species by our ability to dream. If we are capable of dreaming and envisioning a future that is different, better, more powerful than the one that we have today, then that future can happen because we have the capability to dream about it.
And that really means being unstoppable, which is what we're all talking about.
We have to have an unstoppable mindset. And I think, you know, in the past few minutes, I never thought that what I said, that I'm a person that has a lot of determination, always been that way, never equated determination to having an unstoppable mindset. But if now that I've been talking to you over the past few minutes, really makes me think that what really carried me on to where I am today and I will be in the future is that unstoppable mindset. I think that was what really empowered me during these years.
I believe it. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and close this particular episode of Unstoppable Mindset. But at the same time, we have to have you back to hear more about what's happening with you in space and some of the other things that are happening. And we'll make that happen. If you're willing to do it, we'd love to have it happen as well.
Oh, that would be absolutely a pleasure and an honor to do that. I'm scheduled right now to go to space, probably sometime in 2026. And I'm also working with the space tourism companies, mostly all of them, being able to meet the CEOs and the high executives to make space travel accessible to everyone, especially with people with disabilities. And during this process, we're discussing about probably me going a little bit earlier so I can be one of those that start providing some input to these companies to say, how can we make space travel more accessible? So I will keep you posted about, you know, when I'm closer to that, when I have a confirmation that something has moved a little bit earlier. And wouldn't it be nice to come back to you and say, hey, I did it, and this is what happened, and share that experience with all your listeners.
Well, if you're in space long enough, I'd rather do the podcast while you're there.
Yeah, you know, they're developing Wi-Fi in space, so definitely
they can do it. We can get good audio in space. No question. Well, Carlos, thank you very much for being with us. If people want to reach out to you and learn more about some of your activities and so on, is there a way for them to do that?
I'm very good if you send me a message through my LinkedIn. That's the only social media that I belong to. I think I'm going to be doing the Instagram in the near future, or my email, and something that you can actually share when you post the episode. I will try to answer as quickly as I can, but give me a little time. But I love to continue this conversation with anyone that feel inspired by the story or would like to know more about it.
And what's your email address then for people?
It is my first initial C and last name, ARCHILLAMD @gmail.com.
Well, thank you again for being here. This has been fascinating and fun. And I'm older than you, but I think I would also love to go to space. We'll have to figure out how to make that happen.
We'll figure a way for you. Maybe you and I can go together.
That would be a lot of fun. I don't know whether Alamo the guide dog will get to go, but I suppose we could get a spacesuit for a dog, but I'm not sure whether he would like weightlessness, but something to explore. Well, thanks. Well, thanks again for being here. And I want to thank you for listening out there, wherever you are in space or on the earth. We appreciate you and we appreciate your comments. So please feel free to email me at Michael, MICHAELHI @accessibe.com, or go to www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. And Michael Hingson is spelled MICHAELHINGSON. We'd love to hear from you. Please give us a 5-star rating when you listen to this. We value those and we value your input. If you know of anyone else who we ought to talk to about being a guest on Unstoppable Mindset, bring them on. We'd love to hear from you. And Carlos, again, thank you very much for being here.
A pleasure being here. Thank you so much for the invitation and the opportunity.
Thanks very much. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MICHAELHINGSON. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled ACCESSIBE. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.